This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome. I'm Cornell Provost Kent Fox, and it's wonderful to have so many of you here as an enthusiastic crowd. Today, we're treated with a special session this Sunday afternoon with John Cleese, who was at Cornell in his role as Provost Visiting Professor, and also Elizabeth Betta Mannix, Professor in the Johnson Graduate School of Management, and also Vice Provost for Equity and Inclusion. This event marks a decade of formal association between John Cleese and Cornell. He's visited campus each time and each year of the past 10 years and brought us new insights and new ways of looking at the world, as well as innovative ways of teaching and communicating. He is part comedian, he's part psychologist, part master teacher, and fully a public intellectual. John Cleese first appeared on British television. Please let me get through this. He first appeared on British television in The Frost Report in 1966. He co-created Monty Python's Flying Circus and later the Fawlty Tower series. Working with the Python team, he produced four films, including the classics Monty Python and the Holy Grail and The Life of Brian. He's a remarkably versatile actor, writer, director. He's had roles in Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew for BBC. He's been in two Harry Potter films, and he's also been the voice of Harold in Shrek 2 and 3. In 1983, he co-wrote Families and How to Survive Them, which later became a BBC radio series. And then in 1993, with Dr. Rob Bruckman, he set up a company that is entitled Videos for Patients, and it was designed to improve the communication between doctors and their patients. Mr. Cleese began his formal association with Cornell in 1999 as an A.D. White professor at large. At the end of that six-year term, the trustees took the unusual act of extending it for another 2 years, and after that, we couldn't allow the association to end, so we reappointed him as a provost visiting professor. And he's just agreed, verbally at least, to continue that association as a provost visiting professor. During his visit as a provost visiting professor last year, he spent time here in Ithaca where he discussed self-esteem with psychology students, screenwriting with theater faculty and students. He met with and had readings and discussions in Beta and Cookhouses on West Campus. He also visited the Weill Cornell Medical College, where he gave a talk as part of their Humanities and Medicine series. On this visit, over the last couple of days, he's already met with Professors Jim Moss and Daryl Bem about their research. He's visited with students from the Keaton House and the Beta House, as well as students in two filmmaking courses, and he's got another couple of days here on campus. For today's public event, John Cleese is teaming up with a member of our own faculty, Elizabeth Betta Mannix, who is the Alan Whitney Olin Professor of Management and Vice Provost for Equity and Inclusion. Betta holds a PhD from the University of Chicago. Her research and teaching and her interest in that area includes effective performance and managerial teams, diversity in organizations and teams, power and alliance, and organizational change and renewal. For the past 3 years, she directed Cornell's Institute for Social Sciences, which promotes interdisciplinary research and is designed to increase Cornell's prominence in the social sciences. In today's discussion, it's going to be wide-ranging. My expectation, you'll hear things that are funny about how to generate ideas. You'll hear about how to keep growing, learning, and trying new things. I suspect there'll be talk about politics, maybe even religion and education, and other surprises along the way. At the end, there'll be time for your questions and comments as well. So please now welcome, as you already have, Mr. Cleese and also Betta Mannix. Thank you.
John, for being here.
We should say something just to make sure the sound's all right.
Yeah, can people hear us? Are we we're good?
Yes. The carts and the temper turnies, call up the old matruses, and there's to be discussion about part of Isaac Bruce together. He moved slowly at the underpinning, fourth frame shows dark. Can you hear me? Victor Borger used to do this with an audience. He would say, can you hear me? And there'd always be some people at the back better who would shout, no. And he would say, how can you answer my question?
There you go. So what I'm going to try to do is ask you a few questions. We've talked about a few of them. I'll admit that in advance. And then we're going to open it up for questions from the group here, which you've agreed to do. So since we're at a university, I thought I'd start with a little of your university life and schooling, too. So I've done a little research on that, as you know.
Before we go on, there's a strange humming.
There is a humming, a bit of
and
a humming.
We need to address that, because otherwise it's going to distract people. Is there anything that we can do to help? Like talk louder or less loudly?
Is that us or someone else?
It's better, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of going in and out. Like a...
Are you getting it with me or just with Beta?
Is it just me?
It's just you. Or just your...
Well...
It's just your mic.
Is it my mic, do you think? Make it lower? Is that better?
Yeah, that's great. Because what happens in these circumstances usually is that people soldier on, pretending that nothing is wrong.
I can take it off. Is that any better? Yeah?
All right, so I think we solved that one.
So you told me you weren't a high-tech person before.
Oh, I'm completely no. I mean, the joke about being Q in the Bond movies is that when I did it the first time, I wasn't Q, I was R. because Desmond Llewellyn, who was Q in 17 of those movies, he had said to the Bond people he felt that he needed an assistant. So it was his suggestion I should come in. And I was there talking to him and to Pierce Brosnan, and we were all in fits of laughter about the fact we're all absolutely hopeless at technology. And here we were, you know, as the gadget meisters, handing this stuff over to Bond, and none of us had the slightest idea how any of it worked. Yes, not strong on set technology.
That wasn't it. All right. So let me ask you a little bit about how you got started doing what you're doing, which isn't a particularly straight path, I don't think, because you started off and going to a fairly well-respected prep school, and you took your A-levels, which we think of as a sort of an advanced tests, really,
yes.
And things like mathematics and physics and chemistry. You taught science. You told me just today you taught history.
Yeah.
You went to Cambridge. You read law. You have a degree in law. And then life took sort of a different route for you.
Well, I think, how many people really know what they want to do?
I don't know. It's some of these kids. See,
yeah,
I think some
put your hand up if you really think at this stage you know what you want to do with your life. Mm-hmm. You see, what is it? That's good. It's what is it? Is it one in five? I mean, is it 5%? It's just over 5%. I've always been amazed that some people know what they want to do. And a lot of my heroes are people who just decided to do something. Like I have a connection with a wonderful conservation zoo on the island of Jersey, which is a small island. Actually, it really should be French, but it's English. It's off the coast of France. And a guy called Jerry Durrell started a conservation zoo there, which is now the model for most of the conservation zoos in the world. And Jerry always knew that that was what he wanted to do. And I think it's amazing when somebody knows and just goes for it. You know, and I have a friend in London called Brian McGee, who's a philosopher. And he always was fascinated by philosophy, but he didn't want to become a member of a university philosophy department because he said, if you do that, you have to stay up with every current trend in philosophy. And he thinks a lot of them are not worth staying up with. So he became a broadcaster who talked about philosophy, but he's done that all his life. I had lunch with him 3 weeks ago. He's now in his late 70s. He's a guy who knew what he wanted to do. And I find that wonderful, but I have never known what I want to do. All I know is that I want to do the next project. Do you see what I mean? And I think deep down, psychology has always been my fascination. And I think when I was 15 or 16, I saw a few documentaries on BBC television that were about psychology, and I can still remember some of them. I mean, there was one in which a cat was offered a saucer of milk, and a saucer of alcohol. And of course, it drank the milk and ignored the alcohol. Then they deliberately did things to it to frustrate it. It started drinking the alcohol.
That's right.
Yeah? And there was another one where somebody was hypnotized, and he was told that when the hypnotist returned to the room, he should go to a vase of flowers, take the flowers out of the vase, and pour the water on the floor. And that's exactly what happened. The guy walked in, he went over, he took it out, he poured the water on the floor. And when the guy said, "Why did you do that?" He said, I sort of thought I saw some smoke there, and I thought someone had dropped a cigarette in. And it was quite clear to me that he was making it up. He had no idea why he'd poured the... And that was fascinated me. That was my first experience of rationalization. So I think I wanted to know about psychology, but I went in the biology group, and the teaching was terrible. Dr. Davy. I mean, just hopeless.
You're going to call him out. You're going to call out.
I'm going to call out his name, Dr. Davy. And Stubbs was the other guy. And there was another guy called Lindsay Jones, who everyone called Flimsy Bones, of course, who taught physics. And at the end of the first term, I came fourth in quite a large class in the physics. And you'd think that was okay? Now, I'll tell you, I came fourth with 27%. I knew I was in trouble. So I switched to the physics class, got my A-levels, got into Cambridge on science, but wasn't deeply interested. So I had to switch to law because there was almost nothing else I could switch to.
So you're saying law's easier?
Well, law was kind of easier for me because I'm fairly precise with my use of words and I can think in terms of categories, which is all law is. Until you start practicing, and then it's about villainy and low cunning, you know. I'll tell you my favorite joke about lawyers, because it actually involves universities. What they say is that in the psychological departments of universities now, for their experiments, instead of rats, they're using lawyers. There's three reasons for this. One is there's more lawyers than rats. Secondly, there's some things that rats won't do. And the third is that in the past there was a bit of a problem because sometimes the experimenters got fond of the rats. And I want you to know that telling you that joke has got nothing to do with the fact that I'm going through a divorce at the moment.
No.
So the point was, I was fascinated by psychology, but it wasn't for about 25 years was able to get back to it by a circuitous route.
And keep coming. Well, and I want to talk to you about that in a bit, because when you come here, you certainly spend a lot of time talking to psychologists as well, and it comes up throughout your entire career, I think.
Well, it fascinates me. I think the most interesting thing in the world is how this thing works and why we do the things we do.
Well, let me come back to the writing for a minute,
yeah.
And I want to come back to the psychology piece of it too, because in your writing, I think you see that a lot. When you decided law wasn't for you, you go on to write for the BBC, and so much of your work is writing, really.
Yes.
I think a lot of people know you as an actor, but I'd say much of your work is about writing, and maybe...
That's right. I always think of myself as a writer-performer. In other words, I write the thing and then I perform it. But the interesting bit is writing.
Is the piece of the sort of producing it. I see that a lot in what you do. And what's interesting to me, I think, too, is that you've talked about some of the earliest work you did at Monty Python was with a group, right? This group of Graham Chapman and Michael Palin and the Terrys. And you've really made no secret that you were not necessarily one big happy group of guys.
That's right.
You didn't necessarily get along that well.
Well, if you look at most of you guys know a lot about music. I'm sure I know nothing about it, but you can all think of bands and how many of them have stayed together. A very special, select group. But on the whole, they break up because there are always tensions between any group of human beings. There's some degree of tension. There's some degree of what's the word? Diversity, and that means often conflict. Mm. And that's why I know better well, because I'm fascinated by the way people work in groups. And she's taught me an awful lot about her research to do with how people interact, and particularly creatively. So it's interesting we're talking about the Python group. Because the funny thing about the Python group was it was democracy gone mad. I mean, no one was in charge, and it's very unusual, I think, to get a good group of people working together satisfactorily when no one is in charge.
But do you think that it made people better? Because it seems like you did play a lot of times to your strengths. I mean, I think some of the things that you did oftentimes were, you know, you obviously are brilliant at physical comedy. You obviously play well that... you know, I'm sure I'm not the first person who've noticed the angrier person in the group, right?
Yeah.
I mean, sort of that seething rage that's going to come forward.
Well, I think the English are terribly funny when they're angry because they absolutely don't know how to do it. And there's an episode that Connie, who my first wife was American. In fact, all my wives have been American, as far as I can remember. Let me think. yeah, all of them. Connie and I wrote an episode called Waldorf Salad, if you know that one, which is all about the fact that Americans know how to complain and the British don't. The British will sit there, as it actually happens in that episode, saying, isn't it awful? And this just food is dreadful and they haven't cooked the potatoes. And somebody comes up and says, is everything all right? Very nice indeed, thank you. Absolutely. All they then do is never come back. But the English are very, very poor at complaining. They equate being angry with losing their temper. And it's absolutely nothing to do with losing your temper. Anger is a kind of energy which, if you can control it, gets a lot done. But if you lose your temper, you dissipate the anger and sort of make a bit of a fool of yourself. But in England, to be angry is almost a loss of face. It's very strange, it's a huge cultural difference.
So how were you able to, if you think of this group of people, you talk about democracy, gone mad. So was there someone who eventually was able to take control of that group to make the decision?
No,
or how did you decide this is the schedule?
Well, what really happened is there were two people in the group who were slightly dominant. There was me and there was Terry Jones. And Terry Jones is small and dark and Welsh and a bit hairy. And the problem with Terry is that he simply does not understand that the Welsh are a subject race. who God put upon the planet to carry out menial tasks for the English. Now, why he doesn't get that, I just don't know. It's beyond me. But it was always a sort of a bone of contention. But seriously, he and I used to lock horns and disagree on almost everything because I was rather sort of snotty and superior and using a sort of cold, rather sarcastic intellect. And he was all Welsh fervor. He felt strongly about absolutely everything, which infuriated me because I didn't mind him feeling strongly about some things, but he felt strongly about everything and he had to have his way about everything. So we would lock horns and the other four, to switch analogy, would get on the scales, and because we were balancing each other out, the others would get on and then the majority view could pretty much prevail. And the extraordinary thing was, if you want to understand the Python group, we were six writers who happened to perform our own material. So that all the squabbles and fights were about the material. They were never about the casting. Which is weird, isn't it? Because you'd think we would want the best parts, but we didn't. Once we'd written the material, we knew perfectly well that Graham should play that, Michael should play that. It was obvious to us.
So if you go back to, you know, your education with science and law, and I think you studied religion as well, right? Were all those things important pieces in your ability to write these unbelievably hysterically funny sketches? I mean, where does that come from?
I think
your
that the...
I think or was it just a waste? The education was just a waste?
No. Because
I'm hoping you're going
to
say no.
No, it did teach me to think. I mean, I think a lot of it, when you look back on it and see what you learn. For example, take trigonometry. It may have been reasonably good for training my mind. But remembering that the sine is the perpendicular of the hypotenuse and all that kind of thing, it was not of great value to me in my later life. And I was taught absolutely nothing about, for example, aspects of religion, which I think are really fascinating, like mysticism. Which, after all, is what the founders of most religions were, mystics, which is something that's completely ignored when religion is taught, because it's made into an intellectual theory, where really it starts with experience. I was not taught anything about health or the way the human body worked, which would have been really useful. I was taught nothing about psychology, which would have been fascinating. But, you know, there was a curriculum there, and some of it was useful and some of it wasn't. And I think it needs to be revised a lot. But the important thing was, I think I was taught to think analytically. But you see, the interesting thing, better, and you would know this, is that if anyone wants to get into for an MBA, all the questions that they're asked to see whether they will qualify to do this splendid program, wherever it is, all those questions are about the critical analytical thinking. And there will not be a single question to test your creativity. And yet, if you think of all the people who really made a difference, the Edisons, these are people who were immensely creative. Now, why would it be that you can get an MBA program without anyone testing your creativity or making any attempt to suggest how you could become more creative? I mean, do you realize how insane that is? You see what I mean? It's a terrible, insane blind spot.
So where do you learn that? How did you learn that?
Well, I learned it because when I was at Cambridge, there was a club there called the Footlights at Cambridge, which was like the Hasty Pudding. And I joined it, and I liked the people in it, because they were a complete mixture of faculty. They weren't all English people. There was no drama department at Cambridge at all. You see, I've never had a drama lesson in my life. I've simply watched people who were good and stolen from them, seriously. So there were a very interesting, you know, there were classicists and historians and scientists and engineers, English people. It was fascinating. And there was also a big difference of class. We had one or two lords and several people from very poor working class homes, and they all seemed to come into this club room where you could get lunch and get a drink in the evening, and there was a little stage about half the size of this. And I loved being there. And the price of being there was to produce a sketch and perform on it now and again. And I suddenly discovered that if I was given a sheet of paper, I could sit down, and after 2.5 hours, I would have written something which had a very good chance of making people laugh. And I suddenly discovered that I had this creative ability, and yet my entire education from the age of 6 to 24, I was very old when I left Cambridge, I went through that entire period without a single teacher ever telling me that I was in any way creative. And I think the problem with the educational system is that, by and large, after kids are allowed to paint when they're young, when that stops, it's all about developing what you can shorthand as the left brain. And very little of it is about the right brain. And yet I believe that a pretty happy and successful life is to do with getting a balance between the two. And I think, to go right back to your question of about 25 minutes ago, I think the reason that I've been successful writing comedy is that I can be creative, but I've also got a critical mind, so that when I've come up with stuff with my creative side, I can then come in and analyze it and figure out what works and what doesn't work.
So where does criticism and sort of play into this? I mean, if you think about recently, you've taken on, I believe, the title of contributing editor, is that correct, at The Spectator, which is a British magazine, a very well-respected British magazine. And you have an article, you can Google it if people haven't seen it, which really talks about some really scathing criticism you had in your career. And it's not helpful criticism. It's just sort of mean-spirited criticism.
But it was very funny to be asked to write for this magazine, which had never given me a good review in 30 years. So my first piece was actually quoting all these horrible reviews. And
nasty, right? Yeah. But there's a difference between useful criticism that you want to take on and say, I'm going to make some changes as a result of this.
Yes.
And mean-spirited criticism. But as you also say, the ability to have self-reflection and internal criticism.
Well, you see, the great thing about being in the Python group is that that group were really, really good on scripts. And they were pretty good on performing. So if you read a script out to that Python group, and they laughed at some of it and didn't laugh at other bits, it was hard to find better criticism than you'd get from that group. People would say, this is strong, why don't you do this? Wouldn't we do that? I don't think that works. And the feedback was phenomenal. And I think we need that. In fact, I have a speech I do to business groups in which I say, isn't it terrific that guided missiles get so much criticism? By which I mean, I hate this mic. It keeps going on and off, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it stopped again. Oh, there it goes again.
Is there anything we can do, Mr. Technology, in charge of auditory problems, make it a little more consistent?
Is it
Can they hear me when I ask that question?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out now if it's both of us.
Because I'm pretty happy to take to use some feedback here if I can get it. But answer came there none.
No. Nothing.
But the reason I say this silly thing about guided missiles is that guided missiles, every moment of the day, are sending out signals saying, "Am I on target?" And constantly getting signals back saying, "No, down a bit and a foot to the left." And they're doing that all the time. And a lot of us are so sensitive to criticism that we don't want people doing that. Well, the only thing is, the criticism has got to be offered in a supportive and friendly way. So that I'm on your side, but wouldn't it be better if? Do you see what I mean? And a lot of the time, I think that when criticism is offered, it comes out of anxiety. And people are immediately focusing on what's wrong and needs to be fixed. Whereas any time that you're giving someone feedback about something, the first thing really is to try and find some things you can say, really, this is good. It can be better, but it's worth working on. Well done. Now, this is how I think you can make it better. And if you put criticism within that framework, then people can hear it. But if you immediately start off by saying, well, this is wrong and this is wrong, then the shutters go up because we all have very fragile egos. Sorry, but our egos are very fragile. And in order to take criticism, it has to be offered in the right way. Does that partly?
No, I think that makes sense. We're here at a university, so I think it's, and you've been teaching, I think, and as you see that, it's something we can all take on. I think it's important. But I'm interested to know if that's also something that, is it harder for people to be critical of you, or do you find it harder to get good criticism now that you are, let's face it, famous?
Yes, people are too impressed in this country by fame. Oh, can't we get these mics right? I mean, what is the problem? The guy's only got to get the sound right. He doesn't have to write a piano concerto or design a cathedral. You know what I mean? He's not hanging upside down from a wire. He's just got to make two mics work. Now, can we manage this?
Gentle criticism. So it's gotten a little more difficult.
Well, it gets more difficult because people. I'm going to give it to you.
Oh,
would you burn it, please? Talking about feedback. If you get famous, people get so respectful of you in this country if you become famous. There's a kind of reverence which is really quite sickening. It's the opposite in England. Because in England, if you're very famous, everyone's envious of you. If you want to be really popular in England, have a big public failure. Nobody feels envious, and they can all feel really good about themselves because they come to your rescue and show that they're still your friend despite the fact they're a terrible thing. Here, there's a big problem getting feedback. If I show a movie and I say to the audience afterwards, "What do you not like about the movie?" they won't say it. I have to phrase it very, very positively. I say, "If I'm going to edit that and show it again tomorrow, what two or three things can I do to make it better?" You see what I mean? But you have to phrase it in this way. People don't like offering criticism. How many times have you really said to any of your very good friends, "You need to look at this aspect of your behavior"? Don't get much useful feedback. This is Jerry. He looks up. Are you here, man?
Yeah,
he's a
blackberry.
I don't know. Yeah, so maybe it's the fatal.
So that's what I'm saying about criticism. It's much harder to get good criticism than you think, and it's very important when you give criticism that you give it in a positive context. Is that fair?
Yeah. So let me ask this, which is related to this. I think I've seen you interviewed, especially before the election of President Obama, and you were certainly very, very positive about President Obama, very strong supporter. And one of the things I've heard you say about him is that, and about the election, about politics in general, is really what a disappointment about our inability to elect a president in this country that was really our intellectual superior. Or at least somebody who wasn't smart. And you were really angry about it. If, you know, yeah. Really pulled no punches about that. And I think that is really related also to this idea of open communication, frankness, ability to talk about what is important. And that's about feedback, too. That's about being able to talk about important issues. Yeah. I mean, I was surprised in many interviews about how, really, you were angry about it. You were not.
I was angry. I have to tell you a strange story today, because I went on Keith Olbermann towards the end, I think on the Friday before the election, because I really wanted people to know about that remark that John McCain had made, when it was in front of a large audience, he had addressed them as my fellow prisoner. In the gym here at the Statler, and I switched on the television, and there was Bill Maher. And out comes Keith Olbermann, and you know the first thing I learned about him? Yes, both of them are. And I think what I loved about Keith is he was getting angry. But I think the problem in America is that you have a head of state who is also the top political guy. You see, in England, we have a queen who's separate from the prime minister. And this means we can be quite rude to the prime minister without sort of insulting the figurehead of the nation. Your problem is that you're much too respectful to the president. I mean, George Bush did not have overrated a single one of those press conferences in the UK. Because they would have sniffed out the fact that he was quite the anger. but he was completely inadequate. He was half the time, he was rambling. You know, you start off with something, it's like listening to Sarah Palin, you don't know where they're going. You get a chance to produce two or three of the phrases that Cheney's didn't make a word like heart.
Lack of communication, the lack of connection, which a lot of it gets down to
this lack of emotion and the willingness to express the appropriate emotion, enough emotion, and frankness is about
flexibility and openness and all those things.
So why is that so hard for people? And you know, Americans, we like to think that we're good at this, that we're open, we're frank, we're able to do this, but we're not really.
Well, I don't know. I think in the 60s you were. I thought that there was an era where there was much more openness and much more clarity and much more freedom of communication. And you see, the English are very uncomfortable with emotion. They just don't like it. It makes them uncomfortable. The whole society in England was, for a long time, basically, you've got an empire to run. We don't have time to be depressed. Buccaneers and cheats, and we were very entrepreneurial. Then suddenly we finally had an empire, and everybody started wearing grey. All grey, and we had an empire. And everybody put on bowler hats or stovepipe hats and started taking themselves very seriously. And I think what you can do is you can have society that's serious without solemnity. You see, solemnity is a particular sort of face that you put on. Well, then sometimes it's appropriate, like public funerals. You know, some great president or prime minister or the crown heads have died, and it's absolutely right to have a proper ceremony in which people are not, as it were, putting whoopee cushions in the room. You behave with respect in public on those occasions, but the rest of the time, what's the point of solemnity? And yet we can have a very serious discussion about our kids' education or something like that and still be laughing. So there's a way that you can have a river, a nice flow of ideas and a simplicity of emotion, and we can explore different feelings without sort of the thing having a monotonous approach, a tone to it. Do you see what I mean?
So humor's going to help. When you see some of the, so your production company, for example, the management company you have, really does, you tackle topics like coaching and assertiveness and how to deliver bad news. For managers who somehow can't figure out how to do that, it seems like the skills they should have with humor.
Yes, I mean, for example, one of the things I've learned that really works is that if you have bad news to give someone in an interview or in a situation like that, give it right up front. Don't beat about the bush for 25 minutes because they sense that something's up, they get more and more anxious. Tell them the bad news. You know, if you've got to fire someone, then say it at the start of the interview, and then give them a chance to be a bit emotional, which is actually reasonable, and then as they come out of the emotion, you can start discussing how you handle it and what you do about it. And in England, the reason we had terrible industrial relations for years was that if you were going to be fired, you know what used to happen? The directors of the company, the fat cats, would stick a notice on the board at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, get on the car, get in their cars, and drive off to the golf course. You see what I mean? Refusing any kind of ordinary human interaction. And if you behave with people and just treat them as proper human beings, they can take bad news. You know, what's the worst thing you do to kids? It's to lie to them. Robin Skinner, with whom I wrote those books, Robin said kids are unbelievably resilient provided you know life. So it's just a question of getting it more, a bit more open. And I didn't feel that was the case in the last 8 years because, you know, I mean, who's going to be open with change? What's the point? You know, and these people know. Rumsfeld used to start his big meetings, you know, at the Pentagon by saying, who's dying? Meaning, who's paying for this? Who wants this meeting? That's a great start, isn't it? Who wants this meeting? You know, this is someone who's really going to listen to a new idea, isn't it? So they got completely stuck on because they're unlike the guided missile, they're not listening to any feedback. And Obama gets in there and he puts in people with different ideas and they have a good argument. That's how you make things exciting and vibrant. Not with a bunch of know-it-alls at the top who are treating all the people underneath as second-class citizens who've got to do what they're told. Whereas somebody once said, I think it was Tom Peters once, he said, why not use the intelligence of the entire organization? instead of just using the intelligence of the CEO and have everyone else carry out his tasks.
So this is really cycling back to your interest in psychology in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me, I mean, a lot of this is about learning for you, it sounds like. I mean, a lot of what you've done from the very beginning has been about learning, bringing in new ideas, and constantly doing something new as you go. I mean, that's another thing that I think is fascinating, is that you never said, I'm going to be a writer, I'm going to be an actor, I'm going to stop here, and that's kind of good enough. You have done, and you name it, you've been a producer, you've been a director, you've been a writer of not only screenplays, but also books. So.
Well, people go on about that, but I've also never done anything brave. I've never been in the armed forces. I'm hopeless musically. I have a bad visual sense. I have no visual memory. I can't think in three dimensions, you know. Stage doing this show. That, I mean, we were going back to Cambridge. My last year, we did this show in the local professional theatre in Cambridge, and it was supposed to last 2 weeks, and then we were all supposed to go off and be, in my case, a lawyer or a teacher or work in advertising. And all of a sudden, there were people there saying, do you want to come and work for BBC? And we would like to take your show and put it on in the West End, which is, I'm sure you know, is the equivalent of Broadway. And so I got into it completely by accident. But to answer your question, after 6 weeks of doing that show, I had a week of being crazy bored because I had done every single sketch in that show as well as I could. And the seventh week, I thought, well, what do I do now? Go out this week and do everything slightly less well. See what I mean? And it kind of depressed me. And I realized after a time that you just have to take pride in making it as good as you can each night. Can't go on getting better, really. If you can keep it fresh, it doesn't go on getting better, as it has up to that time, because it takes you 6 weeks to figure out how to play everything, how to make everything work. And because of that, when we'd done two series, Monty Python, I thought we were repeating ourselves, and that we were taking bits of sketches and putting them together, but we were just permutating and combining, and weren't coming up with anything new. In fact, in the third series, there were only two sketches that I thought were genuinely original. And the others didn't seem to mind. They were just having a good time. And they just didn't hear me say, look, what's the point of doing this if we're not being original, if we're not creating something new? So that's basically why I split. Though there was another reason why I split, which was something to do with the tensions in the group, and that is that Graham Chapman, between the beginning of Monty Python in 69 and the time I left in 73, had become a fully fledged alcoholic, and nobody else wanted to work with her.
That would be difficult, yeah.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I have seen your eulogy of
Have you seen that?
Have you seen it? You should wander around on YouTube and see that. Let me ask you, I'm going to ask one final question and I'm going to open it up to the audience here for questions. So I have to know, and I have to say, I have to be somewhere in the audience, but yes, there he is. So one of his favorite movies of all time is The Magic Christian, which if those of you who haven't seen it, all I need to say is Peter Sellers, Ringo Starr, and John Cleese. The Bill Brenner's also in it, Mark Howell. If that doesn't, you know, pique your interest, you need to see it. You're now in the historian here, Pink Panther 2, 1 and 2, Peter Sellers, right, so we associate with those. But Magic Christian was a movie that you also worked on as a writer and were in. And so you have this interesting sort of cycle of the Peter Sellers connection from your very early career and now, later here now, 40 years or so later. And I think that's really fascinating, and I wonder if you think that there's any sort of, even connection there that has meaning, given your interest in things that are sort of mystical, that are sort of psychological, or that's just crazy. It's just a coincidence.
No, I'm beginning more and more to think that there's something, I don't know what it is, but at least it's interesting, about what Carl Jung called synchronicity. And I'm just just convinced, the older I get, that this is kind of significant. I just think it was very strange that there I was on the exercise bicycle today, and on comes Keith Olbermann, who's a sort of a friend of mine, but I haven't seen him tonight. And there he is with Bill Maher, and there they are talking about Cornell, and there I am sitting in Cornell. You see what I mean? I don't know what it means, but there's something about it. I really believe that. And I think that the more I read about quantum physics, the more I'm quite convinced that this is a very much weirder universe than any people normally allow. And people get very upset with this kind of thing. And if you want one example of what I'm talking about, Google the following word, Gaukula. G-A-U-Q-U-E-L-I-A. Because this is a guy who did statistical research which shows almost, I think incontrovertibly, that there is something, whatever it is, I don't know, in astronomy. He shows that, for example, generals and athletes and politicians have Mars coming over the horizon at the time of their birth more than they statistically should, and with artists do. Now, you may think, what crap, but look at the statistics. It's very strange, and yet no one's talking about it. So I had dinner last night with Daryl Bain, yes, who shows in
a psychology professor here.
Yeah, brilliant guy, great fun. He's also a magician.
Oh yeah.
Totally fun. He's got a paper coming out that shows that there's such a thing as precognition. People know in advance what's going to happen. There is a guy, Dean Rader, who works at the Institute of Illuminating Sciences, is north of San Francisco. And he's done this experiment, which has been reproduced in psychological departments at the best universities all over the world. They put people in front of a television set, and they then show them pictures. There's three kinds of pictures. There's neutral pictures, like a picture of a telephone or a pair of shoes. There are sort of nice erotic, not very strongly erotic, but nice, slightly erotic pictures, and then there's horrible pictures, which are pictures of accidents and operations, very bloody and nasty again. And what they show is that they put those pads that measure the galvanic skin response on people's, you know, measure of anxiety. What they discovered is that before the nasty pictures, but not before the neutral ones or the pleasant erotic, before the nasty ones, which are being generated at random, anxiety is they can pick up the anxiety of the people who are about to see the nasty people. Now, how can they possibly know? Because they're not reacting in that way when they get a neutral image or when they get a pleasantly erotic. 2 seconds beforehand, they know that they're going to see a nasty one, and yet it's being randomly generated. Now, I think she's fascinating, but nobody takes it into account because it's contrary to the current paradigm. So all I'm saying is I think things are much more interesting. But even if you forget all of that and just come down to your own psychology, it is interesting that at 15 I saw this guy full of water and claiming he thought there might have been smoke from a cigarette butt. And then all this time later, I am at Cornell spending half my dinner having dinners with psychologists. There is a kind of shape, and I think if you stay in touch with what you're really interested in, then your lives take on this type of shape. But if you get pulled off center too much by thinking you have to earn lots of money, right, and go for high status, then I think you can lose touch with your core. I mean, the question is, how much do you really need money to make you happy? And all the research shows, not much, right?
Yeah, most of the research will show there's really very little correlation. I mean, after a certain substance level.
That's right. There's a certain level at 20, 25,000.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And above that, money doesn't make people happy.
It's not going to make you happy.
No, so they didn't.
I know you all think it's going to make you happy, right?
But none of you are believers. None of you believe it, yet it's actually true. And so if you can do what you are really deeply interested in, I promise you, you'll have a pretty good life. If you go out and thinking that you've got to do all sorts of things that are gain other people's respect, like get high status and fame and a lot of money, I don't think you will have a particularly good life. with life, but staying in touch with that core is the basis of it all. God, I can talk.
Thank you so much. We're going to stop for a minute here. If anyone absolutely needs to go leave and study for that chem test, you should do that now, and then what we're going to do is we're going to take questions from the audience. What I'm going to have you just raise your hand, and we're going to call people and have you stand up and say basically your name, and if you're a student, what college you're from, I guess, and sort of do that sort of thing. So go over here, cap with the, because you wore that cap, you get to, you have a question.
Mr. You are aware of what Mark Twain said about the Pythons, aren't you?
Well, I thought it was Disraeli. You're saying that lies down by his.
Yeah, I thought that was Twain. Anyway.
Well, probably he said it at the same time.
You know the original Milgram experiment?
Yes.
And then they were repeated last year, and they found essentially the same result. What's your take on this?
Well, my take, I'm afraid, is that there are aspects of human nature which are not very attractive. And in the would you like to describe the Milgram experiments?
You could probably do a better job than I can.
Because you've seen them more recently than I have, and that was one of the things that I saw on television when I was 15 that got me interested. But basically,
you mean the shock experiment?
Yes,
or the separation?
Well, I was originally going to explain the Holocaust.
But there are more Milgram more than one experiment.
Well, do the shock experiments. Explain them quickly.
But I'm assuming you mean the shock experiments.
Exactly.
Which he asked people if they would continue shocking someone in another room who they couldn't see, who wasn't actually being shocked, up into a very, very high level, basically.
And after a while, they would stop screaming because they were presumably either unconscious or dead.
That's right.
They did it again last year, and the exact same results were fine.
And the point was that they were being instructed to do so by someone in the lab coat who was meant to be an authority figure.
Yeah, and so that means that the humans have not gotten better strength.
Well,
which is why you expect that.
Yeah, I think humans hate being upset. There's another experiment. I can't remember who did this. Is there a guy called Lust?
L-A-S-T?
This is all he did. He got some people in to say about as follows. Every single person in the room was a plant, except for one. And they put the guy who wasn't a plant on the end of a row, and they put all the plants in the line. And then they put up something on an easel. And they said, which of these lines is longer, A or B? And it was absolutely clear that A was the longer line. So what happened? All the plants said, B. And they got to this guy at the end and didn't realize it was a setup. He looks and he thinks, B is the location. He says, A. He says, thank you very much. Now we'll do this. Which is the bigger circle? A or B? And they all say, A. And it gets to him. And he's quite clearly, B is the bigger circle. So he says, B. They say, thank you. There's no pressure on it. They're just nice to me. Thank you, very interesting. By the third time it goes down the line, he says the opposite of what he knows is the truth, because he doesn't like disagreeing with all the other guys to be. You see how tragic that is? There's no pressure on him. Nobody's being unpleasant. It's not like Nazi Germany where you could get beaten up if you said something to him. You know what I'm saying? And yet these people will be, by the time that he went down the line the third time, he was in grief. So those are the things that I think maybe need to know about, because it makes us very skeptical about how much can be achieved. We need to know about it.
Thanks. Someone else. So straight back, is it laptop? Yeah. Earlier about creativity and its absence in the educational system. Could you make a few recommendations on how we as students at Cornell could maybe pursue this aspect on our own?
Well, there is a book that I think is tremendously helpful. And the book is called Hare-Brained Tortoise Mind. And that's H-A-R-E. Hare-Brained Tortoise Mind is by a guy called Guy Claxton. And I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But I mean, really, the next time I come here, I should do a lecture, because what I say is different from what most people say, and I'll give it to you in 2 minutes. What it's really about is getting away from the everyday mode of thinking, because if we're under pressure, we tend to come up with stereotypical thoughts. And that's fine, because a lot of the time you don't need to take complicated decisions already. You know what I mean? If we're driving, we don't want to examine the situation. We just want to do it simply and get it over. So a lot of stereotypical thinking is very, very useful, particularly if we are under time pressure, because we can't examine everything. You know? As somebody once said, when you're attacking a machine gun nest, that is not the moment to admire scenery. Or have a breakthrough of an idea, or see the funny side of it. You see what I mean? That's all right, but when you want to be creative, you want to get away from the pressures that push you into stereotypical thinking. And the way you do that is you need to create a space where you can play. Now, there's a great book about play, and what I learned from it is that play has to be separate from ordinary life. In ordinary life, there's so much going on that we have to remember and get done. You know what I'm talking about, all the lists you have to pick up. It's very hard to be playful when you're trying to carry a lot of things in your mind and get a lot of things done. So you have to create a space, and you do that by creating space, boundaries of space and boundaries of time. Space to avoid interruption. So if you are a fat cat, you can sit in the office and say to your assistant, don't interrupt me for an hour and a half unless the building's burning down. If you are at the bottom of the hierarchy and you're young, and then you may have to sit in the park. I had a friend at Cambridge who came from a working class family. He had four brothers and sisters, and it was a tiny little house. The only place he could get any peace or space was to go into the toilet and sit there. That's where he studied for his Cambridge entrance. You could sit in the park. You see what I mean? You have to get where there aren't interruptions. That's the first thing. And the second thing is you give yourself boundaries of time. It starts at this moment and it stops at that moment. It's a little bit like a football game. Boundaries of space, because there has to be a pitch and the only people who are allowed on the pitch are the players. It starts when the referee blows the whistle, it finishes when the referee blows. That's play. Then you can play. And if you can become playful, that's how you become creative. And it's unrelated to intelligence except to the very sort of, you have to be about 95 or something. So that's the key to it, is creating a space where you can play.
Great, thank you. Right here, the tie-dye looks like maybe? I can't really tell. Is it? Oh, it is, it's together, very nice.
I'm David Lynch, I'm not a student. My buddy said, John Cleese is coming to Cornell. And I said, then I'm coming.
Excellent.
I mostly came because Monty Python and your work has been so influential for me, and especially in humor, because I'm not very funny at all. And I was wondering if, and you touched on it, but I was wondering if you'd talk more about humor. And I know it's probably a lot about psychology and the human mind for you, but I was wondering if you'd talk about its function in teaching and society, and how it can be used, and you know, all that sort of thing.
Okay, well, I just did 34 hours of two seminars in San Francisco on this, so I'll try and boil it down a bit. I think the key is this, that in any room where there is freedom, people are relaxed, people are content, they're not frightened, they're not anxious, in that room there's going to be a feeling of ease and spontaneity. And so there's going to be humor present, because you can't be relaxed and spontaneous without there being some humor. Maybe a lot, maybe less, day by day. So it's a kind of measure of are people relaxed. Now that's a little bit different from jokes. I had a friend who traveled on a bus once, and at the front there were a lot of Marines, and everyone was telling jokes. And he said what was interesting about it was that they would tell the joke, and everyone would go, ha ha ha. Like a ritual. But what he noticed is there was no spontaneity, because it was almost like a military exercise. Because people are reacting and it becomes playful, it becomes fun. So I think it's where there's genuine humor there as opposed to just jokes. I think what happens is that people are relaxing. And that's very good at creative. I once interviewed the Dalai Lama.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I said to him, why is it that the Buddhists, Tibetan Buddhists, are always in pins and needles? And he actually answered a slightly different question. He said, what I like about laughter is that when people laugh, they can have new thoughts. In other words, it's a kind of touchstone. If people are laughing, they're comfortable, and there's humor, there's a little bit of play, a little bit of gentle, friendly teasing. If all of this is going on, it loosens up the mind. Because if you want people to go on having the same thoughts, put them under pressure. And that's why I think being around chambers is a wall. You know what I mean? There's no real discussion of things. He knows exactly everything. And there's a sort of feeling of anxiety around it. There isn't a sort of easy flow. And I have a feeling in the Obama meetings there will be a little bit of humor there because there's a sort of a flow about what's going on. So it's a kind of touchstone of the human beings being in the best place themselves. But there is a very interesting academic theory by a philosopher called Bergson. Henri Bergson, I think it's about 1819.
Previous, yeah.
Yes, or
time frame. I can't
tell you
exactly.
Okay, he wrote a book called Laughter, and he says something fascinating, which I really think is good. He says, first of all, that it requires a momentary anesthesia of the heart. Because if you're watching something and it makes you laugh, think of Basil Fawlty. At the moment that you laugh, you ever so slightly withdraw some sympathy or empathy to the character. Otherwise, you couldn't laugh. You see what I mean? But that doesn't mean it's cruel, because we can laugh at ourselves. But it just means that for a moment we step back and see ourselves a little bit of distance, And that's necessary before we can laugh. We have to have that slight distance, because all humor is ever so slightly critical. And what Bergson goes on to say is that it's a social sanction, because we laugh together as a group of society, and it's a sanction because we're trying to get people to behave flexibly. And he says, what is funny is when we start behaving like machines. That's why anyone, for example, who has an obsession is funny, because it's mechanical. They're not flexible anymore. They're obsessed with something. And so all manifestations of human behavior that are fundamentally not flexible, Bergson says, we laugh at because at a deep level, we want people to be more flexible. And I think that's very interesting. The only trouble about humor is that like almost anything, it can be arranged on a spectrum of mental health. Because at the one end, you've got nasty humor. You've got the nastiest kind of racial humor. It's unkind, it's punishing, it's not really very funny. It's a way of taking it out of a particular person or a particular group. And at the other end, you have the healthiest of all kinds of humor, which is basically saying, isn't this state that we're in as human beings absolutely extraordinary? Isn't it insane? Because, you know, we're bound to our biological principles and the sort of stuff that the gentleman I have ever taught me about with those experiments. We're bound to that, and yet we can look up at the stars. As Oscar Wilde said, I may be lying in the gutter, but at least I'm looking at the stars. And here we are in this extraordinary position of being held back by our ego, and our bodily limitations, and yet we can do almost anything with our mind. And when we share that kind of humor, isn't it ridiculous? And that's the best kind of humor, because we're all in the same boat. It's absolutely opposite of the punishing kind of humor.
That was pretty extraordinary. I think I'm going to take maybe one more question right here on the aisle here. Yeah,
okay,
right there.
Excellent. So, my name is Camden. And I recently graduated as a creative writer. And so speaking to you as a writer, I was wondering, have you ever created a character who was completely psychologically different than you that you had to play? And did you enjoy playing someone who was radically different than yourself?
Well, the first character that comes to mind is the character I didn't play in Fish Called Wanda, which was Kevin's character, Otto. And I have to tell you why I got the idea of this character. I hope that God it isn't one. I was wondering what Kevin's character should be like, and I got a copy of Los Angeles magazine, and I opened it up, and there was this double-page spread advertising a seminar that was being given by this little man who was trying to look impressive, but kind of looked a bit... Zen Buddhist Master Rama. And I looked at him, and he had that hair like a full dandelion. You know what I mean? Very not to last very long. And I thought, this guy does not look very impressive. And then I saw the headline, and I promise you this is what it said. It said, Buddhism gives you the competitive edge. is a man who has read everything and understood nothing. So I started writing that, and when I started working with Kevin on the character, I more or less handed it over to him, and at times, he would just improvise. For example, do you remember sitting under the arch? He suddenly did that in the middle of an improvisation. At the end of it, I said, that was wonderful. What was this guy sitting under the arch? He said, what? And he said, oh yeah, yeah, I did do that. I said, but that's wonderful. So we then, as a writer, you will understand this, we introduced that on page 13, we repeated it on 22. Then we get the audience forget it, and we did it again on page 37. The audience forget it, and we did it on 64. You see what I mean? But that is a character that I enjoyed writing very much, because it was so absolutely different. But there are other characters, for example, the 40 Towers guy was based on a fellow the Pythons were staying at this man's hotel. And it was so gloriously rude. The basic principle of British hoteliers, which is we could run this place properly if it wasn't for the guests.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the last hour of our intellectual adventure, and let's thank Professor Mannix and also Cornell Professor John Cleese. Thank you very much.